welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. There's a crisis on the U.S. border with Mexico, but the debate is about whether it's a humanitarian crisis or an immigration problem. Since October, about 57,000 children have arrived unaccompanied by an adult. To give you a sense of the scope, 3 years ago, about 7,000 children were detained by U.S. immigration authorities. This year, as many as 90,000 are expected to be picked up, according to the New York Times. Last Friday, President Obama met with the presidents of Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to address the surge of undocumented kids from those countries to the U.S. After the meeting, Obama proposed establishing a limited refugee program based in Honduras where young people from Central America could apply for entry into the U.S. There's a fierce debate across the country about how to respond. Earlier this month, President Obama asked for $3.7 billion to tighten border security, provide better housing for the children while they're in custody, and to speed up their deportation proceedings. But is that the right response? And why is all of this happening in the first place? Well, to talk about all of that, we are joined in studio by Catherine Tokin, who's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. For over three decades, Catherine has been working to defend and expand the rights of immigrants and refugees, regardless of their legal status. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Holly. Thanks for inviting me.
Good to have you here. We're also joined in studio by Larissa Dugan Cuadra, who's executive director of the Central American Resource Center in San Francisco, which responds to the needs, rights, and aspirations of Latino immigrant and under-resourced families in the San Francisco Bay Area. Hi, Larissa.
Hi, good morning.
Good to have you here. And from Ottawa, Canada, on the phone, we're joined by Roque Planas. He's the editor of Latino Voices at the Huffington Post. Hi, Roque.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So first off, let me start with Catherine and Larissa. How are each of you, I talked a little bit about, you know, sort of the debate around how this is framed. How are each of you viewing what's happening on the border? Go ahead, Catherine.
Sure. Well, you know, increase, and at least that's been played up by the media over the last year, it certainly is an increase, but frankly, it's not new. So especially for groups who have been working along the border, and I think in the Central American community has recognized that circumstances have been driving families and children to the U.S. through Mexico for many, many months. Already last March, the U.N. Had published a report, Children on the Run, that, you know, had explored this. And that was before it really began to have the media hype. These trends over the last couple of years have been very evident. And so it's noticeable, but it's also not new. And it's really, I think, symptomatic of what we understand to be the root causes of poverty and violence that are driving that kind of forced migration.
And we'll talk more about those roots. Larissa, how are you framing this in as you talk about it and think about it?
Well, I absolutely agree that with Kathleen that this is not a new thing. It's not a new phenomena. We know that Central America's history with the Bay Area goes as far back as San Francisco's history in its current form since 1849 during the Gold Rush, and we've been coming to the States since to work, to live. Since the 70s, 80s, that the reasons why we've come here have changed drastically, or I would say it's become a forced migration more than kind of a choice migration. As you know, we had wars in the 80s that depleted the social and capital infrastructures of our countries, leaving us decades behind in terms of our development. And frankly, we haven't been able to recover from that. And it's been very difficult to recover from that given the kind of foreign policies of the U.S. and the region, CAFTA, NAFTA, and the implications of that on our countries in terms of the industry that has been most viable historically, which is agriculture. So people have either fled to the cities in our countries of origin, or they're going to other countries where they can find agricultural work, like Costa Rica, Nicaragua. And then you have, you know, families that have come north, many seeking reunification because we have 3-4 generations of families that have been separated as a result of the war, as a result of the poverty, and then, you know, as a result of the will to be together. In the Bay Area, we've always seen unaccompanied minors in our offices. Again, we've been around 28 years, and For 28 years, we've been processing asylum cases and any type of protection that we can seek for the children, the minors, and then to be able to reunify them with their family members. Recently, like Kathleen said, this is not a new phenomena to us. In fact, we had already, we've been in the region the last couple of years, and we knew that this was happening. We just didn't anticipate the scale that we're seeing right now. It was a surprise in terms of the scale, not in terms of the phenomena. Mm-hmm. And we did anticipate, we knew that we were facing a humanitarian crisis. Anybody who's been in the region in the last 2-3 years would tell you that when you walk in the streets of San Salvador, of Tegucigalpa, or of Ciudad Guatemala, people are living in fear. Guatemaltecos are living in fear, Hondureños, Salvadoreños. And that is exacerbated by media, by poverty, and by the fact that almost every 5 people that you meet has had somebody in their immediate life be impacted by violence in the region.
And let me bring Roque into this as well. Let's talk about the roots of why this is happening now on such a massive scale. As you mentioned, you know, kids have always been coming north in smaller numbers, frequently to reunite with families and parents. But now they seem to be fleeing violence in a widespread manner. So, Roca, you wrote a really good article. Here's how the U.S. sparked a refugee crisis on the border in 8 simple steps. Can you talk to us about how, what you see the roots of this as, and then we'll all, I'll bring the two of you back in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think I agree very much with what Lourdes and Catherine are saying, you know, that this is basically something that's been going on for a while. I know I've been reading and researching about it since at least 2012, right before deferred action, and that was by no means new then either. But the United States has had a lot to do with the crisis that's going on in Central America right now that has led to so many people coming to the United States to seek refuge. There's a long history in Central America of the United States intervening in the region's politics, funding civil wars, and more recently, doing very little to push an economic agenda that can do anything to provide the kind of long-term sustained economic growth and desirable jobs that are going to keep people in the region. Our relationship with Central America has very little to do with partnership. For most policymakers, Central America is an afterthought. And when we do have policy toward the region, it's usually, you know, to put it lightly, is usually, you know, misguided policy. On top of that, I think one of the problems that we're having right now is that while we have this crisis on our border, the debate that we're having in the media, in the political sphere, is not one that's being informed by facts. And I think that that is a constant problem that we're facing. We're having people come out with these talking points that have nothing to do with the actual crisis. We're having people look at this, these children that are showing up on the border as anything but just kids trying to be with their families. And I think that it's one of the main problems that we're dealing right now, is that there is a lot of willful deception in the political sphere.
And let's talk just a little bit more about the roots of this. One thing that you mentioned in your article, but you didn't mention right now, Roque, is the drug war and the effect of that. Catherine and Larissa, how are you looking at the roots here? Why we're seeing this?
Well, we certainly recognize the problems that have evolved over the last, especially over the last decade, in terms of U.S. drug policy, and also what that is fueling. A number of our groups work along the U.S.-Mexico border, and they've certainly been noticing the influx of people whom they consider refugees from Mexico and other parts of Latin America, who are a direct product of some of the violence that has been fueled by the drug war and our policies, how U.S. policies have driven that. U.S. policies are also driving and rationalizing border enforcement. So there's a problem with both border, I think, drug policies influencing and creating, you know, the tension, the hostility, the contradictions within Latin America centered around drugs as a vehicle of commerce, but also violence and criminalization in the broadest sense. But those policies are also rationalizing an influx of money, of U.S. resources in the form of the drones, more border DEA agents, Border Patrol agents, a combination of those factors, which are reinforcing this notion of the border that must be a militarized zone, and is creating also an environment that is very dangerous for folks who are trying to cross for safety. So they're caught in a net, this contradiction of policies. We don't believe we'll ever see a demilitarization of the U.S.-Mexico border without addressing drug policy. It's undermining the political and economic viability of the region, and it's also reinforcing an infrastructure heavily dependent on military contracts and levels of military enforcement that won't change overnight.
And what I've been reading about, a lot of the kids escaping Honduras talk about having almost no choice to go into the drug trade. And so I'm wondering if you could all talk just a little bit more about what's happening in Honduras, which many people are considering a failed state. There was a coup that the U.S. sort of tacitly supported in 2009, ousting Manuel Zelaya. Can you just talk about what's happening in Honduras?
I think that what's important to note also is that, the drug war was mentioned, there's been and I'm saying this strictly from anecdotal experience. I'm Nicaraguan and I've traveled extensively in the region. I've spent a lot of time on the Atlantic coast of Central America, which is one of the main routes where the drugs come from Southern America. And what you have is also this dynamic that has evolved over the last 10, 20 years where, you know, during the wars of the 80s, the war in some way kept our countries isolated, so we weren't a viable path for drug necessarily, and if it did, I don't think that was a priority in our country. People were busy fighting wars and trying to survive. And essentially, what you've seen is a slow infiltration of the drug trafficking into Central America, not just by way of passage, but also becoming like a place where the drugs get processed and cut. And I can tell you this because I was in the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, where an elder was talking about how the white powder was hurting her community. And I said, well, tell me more about that. And she said, you know, the powder comes from the ocean because they have these, it's very sophisticated, have these currents where that carries the drug load into communities. The communities get paid off to hide the drugs, and then continues to get transported up north. What's happened over the years is that this has created viable economies in our communities. And, you know, these are very isolated communities. Many of them you can't even access by road. You have to, you know, it's like days, trips. And so it's kind of a free-for-all for the drug lords. And in some ways, they have had like a high prestige, right, because they brought economy to the communities. But what you've seen is through the Maras in El Salvador, Honduras.
The Mara Salvatrucha gang?
Well, the Maras are in general like organized crime cells or gangs, as we say in the Bay Area or in the United States. And in Guatemala, well, primarily Honduras and El Salvador, there's a very strong presence of the Maras, which in fact was an exported problem by the U.S. We were deporting young people who got gang involved in the U.S. in the 90s. San Francisco was all in the newspapers, 2008, if you remember, with Newsom and all that. And it's like fertile ground for that. You know, poverty is just a petri dish for everything that you can think that goes wrong with society. And what you see now is you have the Maras actually taking over the drug path, which has created a lot of the tensions that are happening. And then that combined with the fact that now they're processing the drugs in the region, and then that's opening it up for consumption. So crack is a big problem right now in Central America, particularly in poor communities. And so that whole combination is creating a perfect storm for violence, because then it becomes about turf. And, you know, before the Maras in Central America, maybe, you know, they assaulted a bus or whatever, but now they're like geographically trying to control turf in order to fight against the southern cartels, you know. So it's very complex, and I'm not claiming to be an expert, but this is a reality, and it's something that I've seen as a Central American in my countries, that, you know, our people are consuming drugs heavily and it's just all creating more violence.
And Roque, Larissa just brought up the fact that many of the gang leaders in places like El Salvador and Honduras were deported from the U.S., became involved, were oftentimes kids when they came to this country fleeing war-torn countries in Central America, got into gangs in L.A., for example, and then were deported back. Can you just talk a little bit more about that phenomenon?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and this to me is one of the really sad things because it demonstrates not just the U.S. failure in Central America, but then also the U.S. failure to make good policy for its communities of color, right? So you have gang members that we've been speaking to, right, or people who were formerly involved in gangs who were, in many cases, refugees from the wars of Central America, particularly Salvador, that started in the 70s, right, and they get to places like L.A., and then they find themselves outsiders, right? And their families are impoverished. Oftentimes they're undocumented. And they wind up turning to these, what are originally just kind of self-protection groups. You know, there's kind of groups of young people that are getting together to protect themselves from getting beat up. And this is something that starts from people I've talked to, start getting beat up when they're little kids. I mean, we're talking like fourth grade kind of stuff. And then what ends up happening is that through the minor crimes that they commit, they end up in juvenile hall, and then they end up in prison. And from that point, right, instead of getting some kind of correction or rehabilitation along the way, what often happens is that instead they become hardened criminals. And they go back into the community right now with sort of, you know, their opportunities more limited and their ideas of being involved in these gangs more entrenched. And then in the United States, what we had when we had the same time that we were cracking down on all of these drug laws and so forth, all these things that made the United States the largest prison system in the world, part of what was going on is that they started deporting people like that, people that were foreign-born that had gang involvement on the record, right? They would deport them back to places like El Salvador. You know, I was just talking to the director of Homies Unidos, Alex Sanchez, and he was telling me about how when he went back to El Salvador, that he saw the phenomenon of the niños huelepegas, right? The glue-sniffing kids that were just these kids that were sort of kicked out into society that, you know, cops would beat up because they didn't want them around asking for change. And he said, you know, they looked up to the people who were coming, who were getting deported, right, who were going back to El Salvador. And he said, you know, before the cops would, you know, treat them like garbage and they would be like, get out of here, you niño huelepega. And then, but then there was this transformation as they started getting jumped into the new gangs. And as he said it, you know, and this is more or less a direct quote, all they had to do was put a number on their face or a letter on their face and go up to these people now and say, you know, give me your money or whatever. And they were so scared of them. And that's very powerful. I mean, and this is sort of what Risa was saying about how poverty is a petri dish for all of these problems.
And that's Roque Planas. He's the editor of Latino Voices at Huffington Post. We're also joined by Larissa Dugan-Cuadra, who's executive director of the Central American Resource Center in San Francisco, and Catherine Tak-Tokin, who's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call, and you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-7888. Talk. What do you think about the tens of thousands of young people who've been coming to the U.S., and how should we as citizens respond? Also, how should the Obama administration and Congress respond to this humanitarian crisis? Should they tighten the border and speed up deportation hearings as being proposed? And if you entered the U.S. illegally at a young age, what was your experience like? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also post comments at yourcallradio.org. And Larissa, one of the interesting things for me in looking at what's happening in Central America right now is that people aren't fleeing from Nicaragua, which was also a war-torn country. That's where you're from. Can you talk a little bit about why Nicaragua is an exception? What's happening there that's in contrast to Guatemala, sure, Salvador, and Honduras?
Well, first of all, Nicaragua does have a migration challenge. It's just that much of our migration is happening south to Costa Rica. So if you go to the region and you read the local newspapers, you'll see the same kind of stuff that we're seeing here about the miners, but about Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And then also even in the number of children that are coming to the United States, the other category, we're talking about Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, but there's a whole other group of kids that include not just Central Centroamericano kids, but children from South America, from the Caribbean, from African nations, from Asian nations. So I want to just highlight the fact that Latinos have become the poster child of immigration. And, you know, that has its own issues, right? And to me, personally, I just think it's part of the racist discourse that we're seeing around immigration. But in Central America, Nicaragua, yeah, there's a unique situation there. Although we have migration, we don't have such a huge wave of migration to the north. I think on one hand, I'm going to maybe project some of my own thoughts, but having grown up in the 80s in Nicaragua, you know, the U.S. was our enemy, and the U.S. hasn't ever really done much for us as a country. And so there's not that great of an interest necessarily to come to the United States. What you see is Nicaraguans going to Mexico, Guatemala, other neighboring countries in the region. Two, that I think we inherited a strong social fabric. We have very strong social capital as a result of the organizing that happened in the 80s. We had literacy campaigns, health campaigns, and all of these were organized at a communal level. So they were very self kind of contained, where each community took care of the health of the children, the education of the children, the families. You had cleanup brigades to make sure that we were creating healthy conditions in our communities. So I feel that what you see in Nicaragua today is still like a legacy from the 80s, where when we have problems in our community, we solve them within our own community. So
there's a stronger social structure there?
Yeah, and I'm not trying to argue that there isn't violence in Nicaragua. There is absolutely violence. And we're also suffering primarily on the Atlantic coast. You know, that's one of the main drug routes. And so all of the communities in Bluefields, all of the Afro-Caribbean communities and indigenous communities have been deeply impacted by violence and by the drug trade. Primarily, it's been, in fact, impacting our health. And what we're seeing is a lot of domestic violence as a result of consumption. But what we also have is a government that has a zero tolerance policy for any type of trafficking. So I'm very proud of the Nicaraguan government for that. They have cracked down on major drug lords, some of them who belong to the Nicaraguan elite, who in other countries may not traditionally be touched, and they were actually made public kind of examples of. So in our country, there's still like a very low tolerance for anything that hurts the health of our communities. And you see a young person doing something inappropriate on the street, the grandmother, la abuelita, she'll come out and she'll knock some sense into you. And if you disrespect somebody's home in our communities, people will like kind of circle around you and be like, clean it up, brother, you know? Not to say, again, that we don't suffer from illiteracy, that we're not suffering from poor health outcomes as a result of poverty.
But you said that Nicaragua has a higher literacy rate than some of the other countries in Central America.
What I said is Nicaragua spent lots of resources during the 80s and in this new government in investing in literacy. Right now, the government has, despite the political tensions within our country, if you talk to the everyday person on the street, they will tell you that the Nicaraguan government has a social agenda. And that's what we're seeing a lack of in Honduras, in El Salvador, in Guatemala. There's a change of government in El Salvador. We're very hopeful for this new government. But we still have the vestiges of military dictatorships in Guatemala and Honduras. And you see, for example, with the drug war, the war on drugs, you don't see health campaigns about consumption. It's all about weapons, it's all about militarization, it's all about strengthening our armies, but it's not really, it's about sharing intelligence, but it's not about launching public campaigns on, you know, the impacts of substance abuse or how to, you know, essentially the impacts of violence.
And that is Larissa Dugan Cuadra. She's executive director of Central American Resource Center in San Francisco. We're also joined by Catherine Taktokin, who's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Roque Planas, who's the editor of Latino Voices for the Huffington Post. And we're talking about the humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, where about 57,000 unaccompanied young people have come to seek refuge since October. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this break.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show.
For those of you joining us now, we're talking about the huge influx of unaccompanied children flooding the southern border and asking, what's the right response? I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Mark Dowie, who's the author of Conservation Refugees, the 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. June 30th marked the 150th anniversary of the establishment of Yosemite as a national park. What is the history of our national parks, and what do we need to know about them? Today, we're joined by Catherine Toktokin, who's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Larissa Dugan-Cuadra is executive director of the Central American Resource Center in San Francisco, and Roque Planas is the editor of Latino Voices at the Huffington Post. And you can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, and you can send us email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let me go ahead and go to Antonio in San Francisco. Hi, Antonio. Welcome to Your Call.
Good morning. Yes, I am in San Leandro, actually.
Pardon me.
Last week, the Oakland Tribune had a question for the readers. Whether the United States should accommodate these women and children coming across the border. The answer on Saturday, you can read it on the Tribune, on Saturday Tribune, was 80% against. That's no. Shouldn't be any accommodation. 20% in favor. Your panel there does not reflect at all that 80%. This issue of the label children is very misleading, because many of these so-called children, 12 years and older, are already seasoned criminals. And that's why they can travel by themselves. They are very used to the streets. They don't have any problem dealing with other criminals through Mexico. And when we come to the reasons, okay, well, let's look at the reasons.
Antonio, I'm gonna get a response from our panel here to what you're saying. Go ahead and stay on the line, though. Yeah, Larissa.
So I think, hi, Antonio. Buenos días. I think that Antonio's saying reflects a lot of what the feeling is in Central America, too, about the gang members or youth who are violence involved. And, you know, if you go to Central America, they're like, there's people who are like, just kill them all, or, you know, throw them in jail. And I just want to remind people that these are still minors. Legally in the United States and throughout the world, if you're under 18, you're a child. And just because these children have fallen victims and are vulnerable to violence, to poverty, and to the conditions in which they live, doesn't mean that they don't deserve the attention of their communities and their people. I wanted to actually say that, because in this whole discourse, I think that the youth who are involved in the gangs have been so criminalized to the point where nobody's asking what led to them becoming that violent. What conditions have created that level of violence? And yes, sir, Antonio, I agree. Children in Central America are very savvy. They're very smart. We had an 11-year-old who came north by himself. He didn't come with a coyote. He didn't come with an adult. He came alone because he wanted to meet his mother. And his father died. His father was killed by the Maras in Guatemala. So, you know, this idea that every person, every child that's coming here is a seasoned criminal is nonsense, with all due respect. In fact, they have a lot more. If you wanted to think about that, the gang members have a lot more to gain by staying in Central America than by coming to the U.S., to be honest.
And let me bring Antonio back. I appreciate that you're calling, Antonio, and that you do represent the views of many Americans. I don't want to spend too much time with you, but do you have another question for our panel?
Yeah, the question of the reason. When we see Salvador and Nicaragua have former guerrilla fighters in the government, and Honduras and Guatemala have right-wingers, and the policy is not any different. It's exactly the same policy, haven't changed anything that shows the fraud of these so-called progressives in Nicaragua and El Salvador. And the question is this. This is the last point. My last point is, what about the accommodations for the U.S. workers and their children who are forced, because their parents were forced to the unemployment line because of the influx of these illegal scabs?
All right. Thank you very much, Antonio. Yeah, Larissa, and then I'm going to ask Roque.
I agree. I think the U.S. people should ask of ourselves, why do we have unemployment and why we have the poorer education outcomes that we're seeing? When you look at how our government spends money abroad, one day of the Iraq war would be enough to take care of much of California's education problem. So that's a good question. At the same time, we need to address the myth that immigrants are sucking up the U.S. resources. In fact, immigrants produce much more money than they benefit from in this country. Immigrants do not benefit from Social Security. They don't benefit from access to public health. They don't benefit from welfare. Immigrants here work, and have become the backbone of the economy of the United States. They take the lowest paid jobs in this country that are necessary for the functioning of this country. So, yeah, I think that's a myth that immigrants are costing the United States a lot of money.
Well, and we do want to ask, what is the right response to this? And let me bring you back in, Roque. Just on a practical level, the U.S. probably can't absorb all of the people needing help and seeking refuge from Central America. So how do you respond to Antonio and other people who share that belief? And it probably is a lot of people, perhaps in my majority of Americans.
Yeah, no, I understand that, and these are obviously tricky questions. But again, I think one of the things, and obviously respect where Antonio is coming from, but I think one of the things that we have to look at, right, we're a country that has put, I think, far too much emphasis on this issue of security, right? I don't think that if you tally up everyone together, it's a little over 100,000 people, including the families that are coming over with children who are sort of getting put into a similar system here, right? Just to give everyone a reminder, right, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the United States was returning something like 1.6 million people. There were about 1.6 million apprehensions along the border. So that's, but these numbers are by no means large. The reason why we have so much emphasis on them is because these are children. And by U.S. law, children who are not Mexican go through a specific process to make sure that they are not immediately repatriated if they could benefit from an asylum claim or if they've been victims of human trafficking. Now, going back to the question of are these young people criminals, which I think is an important one, right? I think that that's largely a misconception. And I think that what I'm seeing, right, based on the reporting, and it's often difficult. I mean, I think some of the groups have more access to the children than we do because we can't just go in there and sort of subject them to, you know, interrogation by the media when they're dealing with all their traumas, right? But from what everything that I'm seeing reported, and from what the people that I'm speaking to who are doing the intake for these young people crossing the border, these are by and large victims of violence in their country, threats of violence in their country, and almost always coming with a coyote, and meaning that they are also being subjected to human trafficking. And so the thing that I think when people are looking about how to solve this problem, I think it would be it would be a great victory if people could just kind of look at these kids, as people. And it shouldn't be such a big jump, particularly at the level of policymakers. And if we started looking at what is and isn't a security threat, you know, I don't think, but putting more security forces on the border does absolutely nothing. These kids are turning themselves in.
Well, Roque, I have another listener who writes in and says, every person that feels we should be humane and take these kids should take one on their own with no government assistance and commit themselves to these children on their own and not force taxpayers to constantly pay for lack of birth control and poor management. The last part's a little problematic. Catherine, do you want to respond to that?
Well, I just think, you know, this certainly does lift up a question of values and principles for the U.S. Do we still respect the notion, the principle of refuge, of providing refuge? Was it incorrect to, you know, provide refuge to Jewish people during World War II?
Which the U.S. actually didn't do very much of.
And, you know, the thing is that the U.S. has always been reluctant, and I think especially when it's a question of refugee status in this hemisphere, of providing refugee status, and has been very careful about designating refugees. And it's mainly been when it's politically advantageous. Cubans, Vietnamese, there are groups that have received refugee status. There are other groups that have received a certain form of temporary status. For example, Salvadorans, those fleeing Central American violence. Haitians, we have a temporary protected status program. And people have, you know, considered that possibly for these kids. But I think, you know, there is a principle involved here that is very important for us as a country to continue to look at. And it's very disheartening that the administration has not said the words refugee status for this particular situation.
Though the UN has.
The UN has, in its opinion, said that this is a refugee situation, but has not overridden, you know, or come in and made that declaration. There, you know, there's a lot of politics involved. And I think, you know, even without that, we, in terms of principle, really have to ensure, one, to recognize, as folks have said, children must be treated as children. And this has become a very important international principle. At the UN in September, the Secretary General will actually be hearing a report about children in detention. We'll be hearing a report on protections of human rights at borders. Some of these issues that are uplifted by this situation are, in fact, really critical international concerns right now. The U.S. is involved in an intergovernmental working group with six other countries on migrants in crisis, recognizing that migration, refugee questions, a lot of this has changed, especially with the impact of globalization. We can't look narrowly at how migration was once determined, how refugee status was once determined. So there are bigger questions at hand. But I think some of the principles of refugee status, of due process, we have to listen. We have to hear the story of these children who are coming across. They deserve that right. They deserve legal representation that meets their particular needs as children. They should not be detained. The administration has said that they will not detain these kids longer than 3 days. They, in fact, are being detained longer than 3 days, and I think there's a lot of concern that, in fact, they are being warehoused in military bases and that their situation may be indefinite, and that's being coupled with a very aggressive move by the administration this last week to begin expediting removals of families who probably have a refugee claim, a valid refugee claim.
And tell us about the conditions. Now, I think I understand that more than 30,000 of these kids have been placed with family members or other families, which means that, you know, 20-something thousand are in detention centers. What are the conditions like there? And Larissa, I know you work with people who have been resettled here.
Locally, there was actually the Director of Human Health Services, which is the office in charge of the minors under Office of Refugee Resettlement, was in San Francisco meeting with local leadership. And per the horse's mouth, as they say, his statement was that 85% of the children who were detained were reunifiable, meaning that they had a family member, somebody who could take account for them. And based on the figures, you're talking about when all is said and done, depending on how things pan out, we could have about 15,000 minors that need sponsors.
Here in the Bay Area.
Just throughout this whole effort. Uh-huh. And I think to the response of the person who texted in about why don't people just take these kids, well, actually there are people who are working very hard to organize concerned community members, which are thousands of them, who actually want to help and sponsor these children. So we know that the children have family members here, so that's one factor. And I think that at the local level, what we've seen at Caresen is we've definitely seen an increase from, you know, in the past maybe 5 children a week. And these children are a combination of both children who were released from detention centers to family members and children who actually made it across the border, either with a coyote or by themselves. We've actually at Caresa seen many kids who've come in and they said they came alone. And, you know, you have to kind of develop the relationships to learn. These stories are layered, right? So we went from 5 to now, just last week in 2 days, we had 16 children. So there's definitely an impact at the local level.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Let's go to John from San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to Your Call.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I don't want to get in any disagreement with anybody that's on the line today, except that I'd like to make 2 points. The first point is the country of Costa Rica is never really mentioned in these discussions, nor was it ever mentioned in the documentary by Juan Gonzalez, Harvest of Empire, which listed all the reasons for the migrations to this country going back at least 50 or 60 years. And that is that the country of Costa Rica got on the right step back in the 1940s. They decided not to have an army. They have a civil guard subject to civilian control. They put their money into education and public health. And today they have the highest gross national product in the region, the highest per capita income, 96% literacy, lowest infant mortality, a politically viable middle class, and they have a strong public sector. In other words, they have a public utilities system, electric power, etc. They were the one country that voiced strong opposition to having to join the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And the only reason they finally passed it was George Bush's ambassador back in 2007 threatened them with losing most favored nation status if they didn't support CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement.
So, John, I'm really glad that you brought up Costa Rica. Do you have a question, or do you want them to just respond to that?
Well, I'd first of all like them to respond, but I'd also like to say that in the countries that are sending these young people up here, they seem to have a ruling class coupled with their military that remind me of Tsar Nicholas II of Russia. They seem to have no empathy at all for their own people. This is another things that's somewhat perplexing to me.
All right, let's get a response. Thanks very much, John. How about we'll start with you, Roque?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that those are all very good points. That's true. And I agree in part with that analysis. I would just say that I think that it's incomplete. I mean, one of the reasons why Costa Rica is so prosperous and was able to create those social institutions is that Costa Rica, from very early time, adopted a very sensible and democratic agrarian policy, right? And so when you look, Latin America is the most violent region in the world. And when you look at why Latin America is the most violent region in the world, it goes back much further than just the drug war, right? The drug war is more sort of symptomatic of larger problems. Latin America is a place that has had very unequal land tenure, right? We're not used to thinking about the politics of farming, but that's really what a lot of this is about. It's just that because people couldn't make it in the countryside, they end up in the cities. And because there's no resources in the cities, they end up either migrating, and a lot of times they get involved in crime, and that sort of provides the basis for some of what we're seeing. Now, in the countries that are very violent, in Central America, the so-called Northern Triangle countries, that's where you start to see the United States very systematically opposing any kind of sensible agrarian policy. And in order to change that, in order to have land reform back in the day, that's when these guerrilla movements sort of started. So That's sort of the background to the conflict. So, I mean, that's part of the reason, at least in my view, part of the reason why you're seeing Costa Rica develop in a different way, right, is because it had like you said, things that were working well to start with, but you didn't have the growth of this tiny elite fighting to control all of the land and make everyone else a peon, right? So its experience is a lot more analogous to, say, Uruguay.
Yeah, Roque, very quickly, Larissa, because I want to get to more calls.
I think I want to underscore the fact that Costa Rica has been designated as a favorite nation has a favored nation status. And I also want to highlight that the very dictatorships that led us to where we are today, the Somoza dictatorship, many of the dictatorships in El Salvador, in Guatemala, Honduras, were all fueled by U.S. foreign investment dollars. Costa Rica did not see that pattern, and Costa Rica also had the stability of not being invaded. And so they've had much more stability, and you're seeing a different outcome as a result of that.
And Michael writes in and he says, the quote-unquote problem of children coming across the southern border is a result of a failed war on drugs and will only be quote-unquote solved by across-the-board legalization of the drugs now considered illegal. It's a U.S.-created problem. The U.S. can solve it, if at all. In the meantime, we should treat the children as refugees and grant them asylum, no questions asked. That's from Michael in San Francisco. Let's go to George in San Francisco next. Hi, George. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. We hope to hear it asked, how would this problem of so many children being displaced and migrating across the border from Mexico to Texas and elsewhere in the United States, how would this be different if the U.S. administration, the current one, had not supported a coup in Honduras?
Anybody want to take that? Would the conditions in Honduras be different?
I don't think that you can turn over. I don't think that something that's kind of been bubbling for so many decades would be so drastically impacted by a coup or not, to be honest with you. It's kind of the coulda, woulda, shoulda. We don't know what the outcome would have been. But I unfortunately, in my heart, doubt that that would have made a difference because of just the geographic, socioeconomic issues that are happening in the country.
And we've just got a few minutes left in the program, so I really want to focus on how we respond, both as citizens and at a political level, from each of you. Congress is only going to be in session another week before they recess. They haven't passed anything, let alone comprehensive immigration reform, but any emergency spending bill for this crisis. Why don't we start with you, Catherine? What should we be doing?
Well, I think we do have to support the designation of refugee status for these children. Our folks on the border, especially Texas, do note that the numbers have declined considerably by 75% over the last week. So 500 into Texas this last week as compared to 2,000 a week just before that. That doesn't make this problem is going to go away. I think we've addressed some of the long-term structural systemic issues that are behind this, that are a backdrop. That is going to remain, and I think we'll probably see fluctuations in the numbers. So I think we have to go back to the principle of refugee status and ensure. And I think it's our responsibility. And this supposedly is part of our grand tradition and history of the United States is to ensure that people have a chance to flee from persecution. If they're fleeing from persecution from violence, for safety, we should at least provide that opportunity, that opening. And I think we're as generous a country as could be, certainly to provide for how many thousands of children, and they are children, seeking a life. And to me, it's just tragic. And anyone, who's a parent, or if you're not a parent, to think about kids who don't have any hope. I mean, imagine what it takes to leave if you have family there or to be separated from your family and to go on that trek.
And it can be a very dangerous trek through Mexico.
Absolutely. And we're talking about the children who are alive. So a lot of our groups on the border are dealing with dead children. And I want to make that point because there are thousands of migrant dead along the border. That includes children who are fleeing from violence and whose remains will never be recovered. Their parents will never know what happened to them.
And let me go to Roque. Roque, in about a minute or so, can you tell us what you'd like us to be thinking about or doing?
Well, it would be nice for me to see people focusing on issues where there's actually evidence that things are going on or that we can make an impact. They need to stop blaming this all on DACA. There's absolutely no evidence to support that. They need to start thinking about, not only what to do with the kids that are already here, and I think a welcoming attitude is not only in the American interest and part of our tradition, it's also part of U.S. law, at least right now. And then I think that there should be a lot of thinking about how the United States is going to partner with Central America to change this in the future, and that starts with long-term economic development that's sustainable and equitable.
And we're going to give you the last word, Larissa.
Thank you, God. That's a hard task. I think what we have to recognize is that the U.S. needs to break its bubble, and it needs to know that we are part of a global state, per se, of the world, and that our policy, there's always a cause and effect. And so if we make good investments, we're going to see a great return. If we make poor investments, we're going to see a catastrophic return, which is what we're seeing right now in Central America. And so we need to just reconsider how the U.S. is investing its precious resources, and how those resources are making the world better for everyone.
And Larissa, how would you respond to somebody who says, well, if we were welcoming, wouldn't we just get a flood of more refugees, economic or otherwise?
That's, I think, what the Republicans have been saying, you know, like, let's punish person A so we keep person B out. That's an immoral position. In fact, that's so contrary to the what's at the core of the fabric of the U.S. society, which is justice. There is no evidence, again, taking on Roque's keyword, no evidence that if you give protection to these children, more children will come. That is not why children are not coming because other children came. Children are escaping, and there's a huge difference there. And I want to highlight that Guatemala is receiving children every day. Mexico is receiving children every day. Nicaragua is receiving children every day. Costa Rica. So this is a humanitarian crisis, and the United States is not the only country in the neighborhood that is being impacted by this. So it's time for the U.S. to open its doors and start being a good neighbor so we can have a good neighborhood for everyone.
All right. That is Larissa Dugan-Cuadra. She's executive director of the Central American Resource Center in San Francisco. We've also been joined by Catherine Taktakin, who's executive director and co-founder of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and Roque Planas, who's the editor of Latino Voices at the Huffington Post. Thank you all for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roque. And we'll put resources at yourcallradio.org. We'll put links to all of the articles we discussed, and that's also where you can continue this conversation, post ideas about how to best respond to this crisis, questions, etc. I want to thank everybody who called and who emailed in. I apologize that I couldn't get to all of the emails. Rose will be back tomorrow morning, and she'll be talking with... who is it? She'll be talking about a national park system and Native peoples. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What are the connections between cultural and biological diversity? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Mark Dowie, investigative journalist and author of Conservation Refugees, The 100-Year Conflict Between Global Conservation and Native Peoples. He writes that about half the world's protected areas were occupied by indigenous peoples, but they were displaced in the interests of conservation. So what is the history of U.S. national parks and Native peoples? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcasts, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.